Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Garth Risk-Hallberg, whose new novel is The Second Coming. We'll also talk with Christopher Schaberg and Mark Yakich about their new book, Little Data. Risk-Hallberg, a Denham Springs, Louisiana native, is the author of City on Fire, a New York Times bestseller and selected as one of the best books of 2015 by many media outlets. It's also the basis for an Apple TV series streaming now. He's the author of the 2017 novella, A Field Guide to the North American Family, and now he's back with The Second Coming, a must-read for the long summer months ahead. Garth Risk-Hallberg, I'm so happy to speak with you again.
It's wonderful to be back, Susan.
Now, I watched City on Fire about the New York blackout of 1977 last weekend, and I noticed you were the producer as well. So I'm curious, what was that experience like for you?
Well, the executive producer role is something of what they call a floating signifier in Hollywood. It can mean a lot of different things. In this case, they kind of gave it to me to sit on the sidelines and kibitz. So, you know, I could throw some notes at the showrunners, and they were free to take them or ignore them as they saw fit. My proudest contribution is that I managed to get a character killed in the series who was not killed in the novel.
So was it fun to see that story of yours come to life right in front of you?
It was a lot of fun, actually. They transposed the series from the blackout of 1977 to the blackout of 2003, which is closer to the time frame of The Second Coming. So it was neat to kind of tap back into the feel of that era. And it's a total trip to see something that's only existed in your head as a three-dimensional set you can walk around and touch.
So here we are with the long-awaited Second Coming. No reference to Yeats or Walker Percy, but a Prince album. And it continues in many ways your love affair with New York, which we talked about last time. But at the same time, in this book, you're painting on a larger, grander American canvas. Islands and shorelines, all kinds of different things abound. It just as a feeling of, you know, you're busting loose, dude. So how did it feel to you in the writing of it?
It felt great to be back in New York in a different time period, and it did feel great, as you suggest, to get out and do something different. What I had been looking for specifically is a way to write about the world that I grew up in, which was not the city, but the rural South. And I kind of cast back in memory to the early 2000s when I was living in Washington, D.C., and would drive out to the eastern shore of Maryland. And it struck me as being just so similar to coastal North Carolina, where I grew up. And that gave me a comfortable place to set some of the action, you know, farmland, but close to the beach, where I could kind of talk about my experiences growing up without necessarily getting in trouble with any of the people I grew up with, you know. Say, no, it's Maryland. It's very different.
So tell us about Jolie Aspern and that pivotal moment in a New York subway that sets everything in motion.
Well, Jolie was the character who really gave me the novel. I'd had this idea rattling around my head for probably 20 years about an estranged father and an estranged daughter and his kind of desperate, questionable, half-crazy attempt to save her from what he sees as grave trouble. But I'd always had her in my mind as younger somehow. 3 or 4, and it just I couldn't get the drama to happen. And then one day in 2016, I came back from a walk and I sat down to write, and I just had this scene of her at the start of the chapter that you're talking about, and I realized she was 13 or she was 14. She was almost old enough to make adult decisions. And at the end of that chapter, I had her make or not make a decision that looks very problematic from the outside. And all of a sudden, the novel just kind of took off.
And that's a very dramatic age that offers so many possibilities.
It is. In there are so many ways at that age that you feel like you're an adult and that your choices have the moral weight of an adult. And none of the adults in your life see you that way. At the same time, all of the adults around you expect you to be an adult in all these ways where you're still really a kid. So she's a New Yorker. She's headstrong. She sees herself as very tough. But she, as the novel opens, is really suffering, not least because her dad has disappeared 3 years ago.
Well, in City on Fire, there was such an artistic depiction of the city itself. It seems to me, or feels different to me in The Second Coming, because we feel more of the pressure of contemporary life at all ages within the characters, as if we're, you know, a young teenager like Jolie, or like her father Ethan, a recovering addict and felon, but a good enough actor to be on Law and Order now. And you said that all of the characters in City on Fire were you. Did you feel that way about The Second Coming? It's just the sense of pressure to me is so different.
I felt in a way that they were, each of these characters, specifically Jolie and Ethan, were even more me somehow. Mm-hmm. And that seemed impossible when I sat down to write. I kind of took that as my mission. You know, I have to feel as close to them as I did to those 9 characters in City on Fire who I just left behind.
Sure.
And it took me sort of longer, particularly with Ethan, to tunnel my way in because he and I share a past, and it was hard to write about. But by the end of the thing, you know, I really came to feel that they were, you know, each of them was kind of half of me. Consequently, each of them has something of the other in him or her. So, you know, the daughter has a little bit of the father in her, and the father has a little bit of the daughter. And that's the source of this, for me, kind of magic tension.
Well, it's partly that Dickensian empathy at work, isn't it? That's what you have in such abundance, I think.
I wanted to keep the empathy because it's something that is important to me and has been so meaningful in my own life. And at the same time, I wanted to push it a little further by looking at characters who are sometimes a little harder to empathize with, because I think I have found sometimes the people that we're the closest to that we have the hardest time empathizing with. It's very easy to go out in spirit to a perfect stranger, but sometimes when you look around your own family, you know, it's much harder to go out in spirit. And that's kind of the journey that I wanted these two to be on.
Was it hard for you to write her? Because I had such a love for her, but such regret that the adults in her life kept disappointing her or letting her down. Roshi, Steve, Mrs. Lesser, all those people she thought, you know, she might turn to for help are not there.
You know, that's a funny thing about the age, too, that you mentioned. I think in my experience, it wasn't hard for me to write her because I knew all, from the moment she was 13 or 14, all of a sudden, I knew, okay, that's me. And, you know, that was very much my experience at that age. It's just so hard for adults to see you. As I've become a father, I sort of experienced that with my own kids. My two oldest are entering their teenage years, and you just go, you might be leaving the house and go, you know, do I have my keys? Do I have my umbrella? Do I have my kids? It's become kind of an accessory to your life, and you forget that they have a whole world going on inside them, and that's what she needs someone to see. And it's the most unlikely person. You know, it's her father, who's a total mess in other ways, and a near complete narcissist. He's the one who can do it. He's the one who can see her
and sense her from a distance, from a great distance. Yeah. He can sense her. If you're just joining us, my guest is Garth Risk-Hallberg, whose new novel is The Second Coming. Well, I wonder if you'd read a section for us from Babylon Revisited, Revisited.
I'd love to.
And set the stage for us a bit so we know where we are.
Okay, so the year is 2001. It's now September, October of 2001. And so Jolie is a little girl. She's, I think, just turned 4. And she's living with her parents in a kind of ramshackle, quasi one bedroom in Spanish Harlem. She's been supposed to start preschool, which has been kind of a crisis for her father, who's been taking care of her. And that's been giving him the sense of meaning and vocation he's been lacking. And he's actually very good at it. And now two planes have flown into two buildings and kind of blown a hole in the middle of all that. Here's the page. Oh, and I should say, this is in his voice, and mm-hmm. he's writing to her, to his daughter, many years later. All classes canceled, your pediatrician's visit and the start of preschool further delayed. We spent the rest of the week tucking you in the umbrella stroller you'd already outgrown and pushing you for miles through the city, trading off, one-arming the handle so we wouldn't have to let go of each other's hands. Once or twice, as if on our old rambles, we kept going until we hit the cordon around Lower Manhattan, where, after a few silent minutes, we would have to turn back. And when we stopped for supplies, I would look at the clerk across the counter of the bodega or CVS or the bagel shop, or at the messenger idled on his bike, or the teacher suddenly stripped of students, or the banker waiting at a light, or the trans woman taking it all in from a Siamese connection. And for a second, our eyes would meet. And it was like we were really all seeing other people, you know? Like each knowing the other had to be feeling the same thing, but in this way, utterly peculiar to him or her or them. Everybody having lost somebody somewhere. Everybody somebody's child. And how rare it was, I thought, to recognize a moment like this even when you were in it, like living inside a poem. Though maybe it was just me and not your mom who knew what to do in between the lines there where things broke down, because I'd already seen a whole world's worth of human beings blanked out once before. Over the years, I've tried to tell this story in any number of meetings, Jolie, but the thing I could never bring myself to be honest about when I did was the feeling of wonder, too, of a kind of suspension radiating outward, of a utopia inscribed inside a hell, of life qua life, maybe, because life as we knew it, the one foot in front of another thing that had given me such trouble, stood revealed as completely absurd. I don't mean that the grief wasn't awful or everywhere. It was on a scale to match the 3,000 people whose murder we'd all just witnessed. When the little capsule biographies began to appear in the Times, your mother would force herself to read every word, saying even one of these was worth everything the paper had ever gotten wrong. But the corollary of all those people dying was this heightened recognition that there were others still alive. And to lose sight of that again, I thought I'd learned, would be to dishonor the dead, even if you believed what you're doing was the opposite.
That just seems so true to me, not just for that moment, but for this moment as well. You know what I mean?
I think so. Sometimes the things that are the truest are the hardest to keep in front of us.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what I wanted to capture about that moment and my recollection of it, I mean, it was more than a recollection. I remember just kind of writing it as I was living it 22 years ago, was how directly in front of us that truth suddenly was.
We've been talking with Garth Risk-Hallberg, whose new book is The Second Coming. You can meet him when he appears in conversation with Gary Cernovitz, Friday, June 14th at 6 at Octavia Books. Garth, thank you so much.
Thanks, Susan.
Whenever Mark Yakich and Chris Schaber collaborate on a project, the result is sure to be interesting, no matter what the subject. Their new book, a collection of micro-writings called Little Data, sums up the delights and challenges of parenting, among other things. Chris Schaber is the director of public scholarship at Washington University in St. Louis. His most recent book is Adventure, An Argument for Limits, and Fly Fishing. Mark Yakich is the Gregory F. Curtin S.J. Distinguished Professor of English at Loyola University, New Orleans. His most recent books are Poetry, A Survivor's Guide, and Football, An Object Lesson. Chris is speaking to us from St. Louis while Mark is here in studio. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Susan.
Thanks, Susan.
This is the most delightful book. with entries from A to Z, it's you pick it up, read a little bit, put it down, pick it up again because you can't bear to be without it. So talk a little bit about how this idea took shape and came to be.
It took shape because we have a lot of children. Chris and I have 6 kids.
You do?
He has 3, I have 3. And at first we just had one. I had one and
Chris, I remember Owen.
Owen was 2, and now he's about to be 17. And Chris met him when he was 1 and on his flyback when he got the job at Loyola. And I had been here a couple of years. And then suddenly there was another kid. And suddenly we had this whole gaggle of kids. And Chris and I would text each other, usually late at night, early in the morning, about how our children were doing various things that were annoying. Or mm-hmm. It was a struggle being a parent. At some point, one of us started calling the kids Little Data, LD for short. So uh-huh. There's all these texts between us that go, the LD are driving me nuts, or I only have 2 out of 3 of the LD. I'm in business here. Chris, what do you think? How did this thing start?
Well, yeah, the LD or the Little Data really was our own kind of snarky retort to the overwhelming drive toward big data. I mean, big data was going to, you know, fix our lives and prove everything that was correct and give us the best practices for parenting, for instance.
Oh,
and
sure.
So we sort of realized, well, it's funny because our children are actually always undermining or subverting whatever we think we're doing right or that we've got figured out. So the little data was a kind of
foil.
Retort.
Yeah.
The foil. Yes. Thank you. The LD were a foil.
And did you decide from the very beginning to go from A to Z?
Well, the project took, I think we spent 8-9 years working on this on a Google document back and forth because we had other projects going on, own books, but this one kept nagging at us. We would work on entries randomly, whether it's books or dogs or friends or cats or other things, and we probably wrote 300 or more, and only our 100 are in this little book, and we just tossed them at some point. At some point, the A to Z made sense because of the data idea, and we couldn't figure out another good way to organize from piece to piece, so it just made the most sense.
Where are the other 200?
Chris, where are the other 200?
On some Google Doc somewhere.
The kids took them.
Kids are holding them hostage for some reason.
Yeah.
They'll read them when they're older, and they'll say things to you about them, I'm sure.
Well, I tried to get Owen, who goes to Ben Franklin right down the street, to come today because he has study hall right now, to read a couple. He wouldn't do it. Big surprise.
Well, so sorry.
And speaking of that, when our books arrived, actually when I think it was the proof that arrived, and my older two, Julian and Camille, I sort of peeked in on them, and they were taking turns reading them aloud to one another, and sometimes laughing, and sometimes saying, you know, Dad is weird. You know?
Well, I'm glad you got some laughs. I really am, because sometimes it can go the other way, I know. Now, this form, how did you find this form? Was it a pleasure? Was it challenging?
I think it probably is the form of these essayettes or these micro
essays, or you just call them micro writings. I like that. I don't know. I think it probably lands somewhere in the sweet spot between the long form essay and then the very short poem, the almost imagistic poem. Mm-hmm. And that's the place that is somewhere between where Mark usually writes and where I usually write. So that, but I don't think we did that consciously, it just was sort of where our writing landed.
Mm-hmm. There were a couple rules at a certain point. I remember we decided there had to be some kind of stat or fact, yes, or piece of data in, uh-huh, each piece, even if it was maybe made up. And then also we liked one word titles at a certain point, I remember, or just a single kind of entity as a title.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But yeah, the facts, there's a little disclaimer at the copyright page. It says, data cited by the authors may or may not be accurate due to the nature of the space-time continuum. Any alleged advice or strategies contained herein may not be suitable or replicable for every situation.
So you took care of that. I mean, now, you know, so many women writers have said they write short stories because they had children and had no time. Oh. So now we see this works for everyone.
Yeah, that was probably one of the constraints too. Is there just wasn't time to write a novel about parenting, or some manual that is A to Z, fully.
It was also sort of a teachable form. I remember one class at Loyola, mm-hmm, last spring, when Mark came in and we shared a sampling of this book, and then the students wrote their own little data pieces, and you know, it's something that can be done in an hour and a half class.
And then everybody gets to read them and laugh. And
exactly.
Go, oh, that's fantastic. Well, you know, I have to hear the one about books. That is one of my very favorites. So would one of you please read that one?
Mark, take that one.
I'll read books. Books. People don't read books anymore. You hear that a lot. And yet, according to the numbers, more books are being sold each year than ever. And more bookshops are popping up everywhere. The children ask to go to the library every weekend. They discover graphic novels, and in the quote teen section of the library, graphic novels are in fact graphic. And the I Survived books, which they devour. 9/11, the Nazi invasion, they pronounce Nazi, the sinking of the Titanic, as long as they're reading, right? In order to read, you need quiet. You demand it, cry for it even, against the din of parading children after dinner. The stainless steel mixing bowl has become a drum keeping rhythm to your madness. Later in bed, you relish it. You can read a novel. You can audibly track the full arc of an Airbus on final descent from far horizon to reverse thrust upon landing. Later still, you will wake up from a novel-triggered nightmare. It's called The Anomaly, a mind bender replete with a Boeing 787 and multiversal travel. Lying there, you will think about your job and all the goals you need to set, the deadlines you need to meet, the deliverables you haven't yet delivered. You'll picture your feckless manager at his cluttered desk, and all you want is for the quiet to end, for your children to begin climbing loudly over you, for your book to clatter to the ground.
I love the way you say a novel. You know, says so much. All right, now, Chris, you have chosen restaurants. You would like to read that one.
Okay, I'll read Restaurant. One out of every two children goes ballistic in a restaurant. These odds may sound favorable, but when not ballistic, the other options fragment into five remaining paths: happy, docile, dejected, ornery, and resigned. To the point, the odds are not in your favor to have a happy child dine with you at a restaurant. On the other hand, 73% of adults at restaurants are secretly seething. In the final analysis, when it comes to eating out, children turn out to be just downsized adults who are perhaps only slightly more expressive. They may even enjoy their food.
Oh, how I love the word ornery. We need to use it more often, I think. We've been talking with Chris Schaberg and Mark Jakic about their wonderful new book, Little Data. Chris, Mark, thank you so much. This book brought me so much joy.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Take care. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The Tennessee Williams and New Orleans Literary Festival and Baldwin and Company continue their free coffee and craft sessions with Gabe Soria, Saturday, June 8th from 10 a.m. to noon at Baldwin and Company. Free, but register in advance. Allison Alsop discusses her new novel, Foreign Seed, with Anne Babson, Saturday, June 8th at 4 at L'Union Française, 4522 Britannia. Megan Holt and Denise Frazier curate the Purple Poetry Circle, a poetry tribute to Prince, Sunday, June 9th from 5 to 7 at Three Keys in the Ace Hotel. It's an all-star lineup: Mona Lisa Saloy, Christian Lee, Jose Torres-Tama, Nikki Umel, C. Lee McGinnis, and Carol Babel. Come out and celebrate Prince's birthday and bring your own poem for the open mic. David Wahl discusses his novel All That Really Matters with Tim Williamson at the News Society, 2040 St. Charles Avenue. That's Tuesday, June 11th from 5:30 to 7:30. Pete Candler discusses in Signs a Deeper South, the Beauty, Mystery, and Sorrow of the Southern Road, Thursday, June 13th from 6 to 8 at Baldwin & Company. Garth Riss-Kahlberg discusses in Signs the Second Coming, Friday, June 14th at 6 at Octavia Books. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, with major support from Rouse's Markets. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.